And so our reading this evening is from Romans chapter 1, verses 18 to 23. That's on page 1131 of the Bibles on your chairs, page 1131. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honour him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools, and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles.
Thanks very much, Caroline. Be a help to me if you kept Bibles open and these white sheets headed "Why I Can't Believe." We're going to look through some of those points together. I said the topic we're looking at is how can we know whether God exists? This is a very important topic. God's existence or otherwise is understandably and rightly a topic that evokes very passionate responses. Hands up here who's seen the Stephen Fry outburst recently. It was on all over social media. Good number of us. He launched an anti-God tirade on an Irish TV show a couple of weeks ago, and Stephen Fry got 2 million YouTube hits of just of that little clip even before the programme was aired. Russell Brand, he took the opportunity to kind of post his own reply, which is a 10-minute clip entitled "Is There a God? Yes, and Stephen Fry Proves It." And there are people who don't engage with this question at all of whether God exists. You know, they just try and get on with their lives and shut it out. There are other people who treat this whole topic as a philosophical game. It's just a chance to win points off other people and with clever arguments. But I think what these two men, Stephen Fry and Russell Brand, have in common is that they both get the huge significance of the question. It matters. As C.S. Lewis put it, Christianity, that is the claim that there is a God who has entered our world. This claim, if false, is of no importance, and if true, is of infinite importance. The only thing it cannot be is moderately important. So I'm really glad we're here today and we're actually engaging with this topic, which is so important for us all. But I guess for a lot of people, this whole question seems impenetrable. So many intellectual giants over the centuries have come to different answers on it, disagreements. And therefore, people conclude that we must therefore be left in the dark. We're sentenced to ignorance and confusion and uncertainty on this topic. But today I want to look at the way the Bible addresses this question and what help it can give us on this whole topic of how human beings can get true knowledge about our Creator. And the first answer in the passage we had read is, I'll put it there on the top of the sheets, is that creation reveals God. So let me read from verse 19 again, Romans 1, verse 19. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. So this verse saying that God is not hiding. Verse 20, for here's God's invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, that's talking about God's godness, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So these verses are saying that just like an artist reveals themselves through their art, it's saying that the divine artist has revealed himself all over his creation. Elsewhere, this same writer, the Apostle Paul, he points specifically to the wonderful gifts that God lavishes on us as humanity, as evidence for why we should respond to him. I'm going to betray my radio loyalty, which probably won't be a surprise to you. Radio 4 ran a programme a few years ago. It was a competition for Britain's most romantic man. And the winner was a guy who had actually been married for quite a while, but throughout his married life, every day, he'd always just left little notes to his wife I love you, I care for you, I miss you. And he'd leave them, you know, one on the bathroom mirror. The next day there'd be one. She'd open up her packed lunch and there'd be one. Or, you know, she'd unfurl her umbrella and there would be another one. And it's a great picture of the way God has littered love letters all over creation for us. So today, the fact that we have air in our lungs, we have food on our plates, and we have friendship and beauty and colours and love and sex and music and technology, none of these things happen by accident. They're all messages of love and care for us everywhere we choose to look. Now, there are different kinds of traditional arguments that people put forward for the existence of God. You might have studied them in school or in philosophy or something like that. One of them is called the cosmological argument, and it argues from the fact of creation. So the idea is that the Big Bang must have been caused by something or someone. Well, who did it? Another is the teleological argument. And that argument observes that the constants in physics, like the strong and weak nuclear forces and the forces of gravity and so on, all these things are so finely tuned within creation to support life. The world looks, at least, as though it's been very carefully designed. And actually, these arguments have a real force to them. And you can tell that they have a real force to them because all the new atheist books, and all of them, engage with and try and argue against these arguments. So they must have some resonance. But what the Apostle Paul is saying here in this verse is that whether it's the fact of creation, whether it's the fine-tuning of creation, whether it's the order that we observe in creation, whether it's the beauty, whether it's the exuberant joy in creation, he's saying that there's enough in creation to leave people, as the end of verse 20 puts it, without excuse, if we don't acknowledge God. And incidentally, as we read through these verses, it's worth being aware, Paul's not trying to catch out the atheist in particular here. He's actually trying to catch out all of us. So he's saying, look, the most religious, the most ethical, the most enlightened people, no one, Paul says, responds to God's revelation the way we should. This is all of us. Now, you might be thinking, well, is that all you've got, Paul? You know, there is a creation, therefore believe in God. Is that it? But Paul goes on to argue something quite surprising. And he explains not simply that creation reveals God, but secondly, and this is point two, that we already know God at some level. Let me read again from verse 21. For although they knew God, they did not honour him as God or give thanks to him. So if you ask the Apostle Paul, or indeed if you ask other Bible writers, how it is that we know whether God exists, I think they'd say to us, you already know. Not just through a process of rational deduction, but you already know it intuitively. It's as if God has stitched into the fabric of the human mind his existence and his power, so that they're then instinctively recognised when we look at creation. That's why in verse 18, when Paul's explaining what it is that God's angry about in the human race, it's because people suppress the truth about him in verse 18. And of course, you can't suppress a truth unless you've got it in the first place. So the argument here is that even if I don't admit that there's a creator God, deep down, I know that there is one. Now, you might be here today as an agnostic or as an atheist, and you might be thinking, well, that is a pretty strong claim. How are you going to persuade me of that one? Good question. Each generation, there are leading thinkers who are agnostics or atheists, and through the course of their lives, they end up as believers in God. And a generation ago, it was folk like T.S. Eliot, W.H. Auden, C.S. Lewis. In modern times, people like Alistair MacIntyre, A.N. Wilson. And when you kind of analyse their stories and you look at what it is that convinces them, it makes very interesting reading. They usually say something along the lines of, well, actually, I was already living like there was a God, and I finally gave in and I admitted that he's really there. A good example of this is A.N. Wilson. He wrote books famously undermining Christianity. And then in Easter 2009, he came out and he said, I'm now a convinced Christian believer. And he said this: all my secular friends and me insisted on justice, on not trampling the poor, on human rights. If there is no God, however, there is no basis for talking like that. Unjust is just your opinion. Materialist atheism is not just an arid creed, but it's irrational. It says that we're just a collection of chemicals. It has no answer whatsoever to the question of how we should be capable of love or heroism or poetry if we're simply animated pieces of meat. The resurrection of Jesus, on the other hand, which proclaims that matter and spirit are mysteriously conjoined, that is the ultimate key, he says, to who we are. So the point is, this guy, A.N. Wilson, he recognized that he was actually already living like there was a God. And his conversion was just coming to admit what, at some level, he says he already knew. Take another example, C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis, his mother died when he was very young, and he decided at an early age that God simply couldn't exist. The universe is just too cruel. Interesting, it's very similar. If you've been following the Stephen Fry thing, it's almost identical to his argument against God as well. But later in life, C.S. Lewis wrote a book called Mere Christianity, where he said this: my argument against God was that the universe seemed so cruel and unjust. But how had I got this idea of just and unjust? Of course, I could have given up my idea of justice by saying it was nothing but a private idea of my own. But if I did that, then my argument against God collapsed too. For the argument depended on saying that the world really was unjust, not simply that it didn't happen to please my private fancies. Consequently, atheism turned out to be too simple. And actually, a lot of people since Stephen Fry's outburst a couple of weeks ago have been pointing out that atheism, which of course is built on the premises of evolution, which says that the world is basically about suffering and violence. And if that is taken for granted, and if Fry is saying that he doesn't like suffering and violence, the only way to criticize it is by appealing to some standard above or outside of nature to compare it to. So the point is that Stephen Fry's basis for disbelieving in God, just like C.S. Lewis's, assumes at some level a belief in God. Now, sometimes this realization that at some level we all know that God exists, sometimes it comes out morally and intellectually, as it did with these two people, Wilson and Lewis. Sometimes it comes out aesthetically in terms of our understanding of beauty. Leonard Bernstein, who's a composer of West Side Story, he described that when he listened to Beethoven's Fifth, you get the feeling that something is right in the world. There is something that checks throughout, that follows its own law consistently, something we can trust, something that will never let us down. So do you notice there what he's saying? He's not just saying that as he listens to this beautiful music, it gives him emotion. He's saying that as he listens to this music, it gives him meaning. So despite the fact that his formal beliefs are that, or were, that life is just a cosmic accident and there can be no meaning, music made him feel like there is meaning, that it matters how we live. At one level, he's saying there is no plan. I'm an existentialist. But when he hears the music, he's saying, yes, there is a plan. There is a someone or something behind all of this that makes sense of it. So this passage is teaching us that the reason there is so much disagreement, so much confusion about God is not because God is hiding. It's actually because we are hiding from him. Actually, when you think about it, it's almost impossible to approach this topic of whether there's a God dispassionately. We can't approach the topic neutrally. The philosopher Thomas Nagel, he describes the issue like this: I want atheism to be true. It isn't just that I don't believe in God and naturally hope that I'm right in my belief. It's that I hope there is no God. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want the universe to be like that. You probably know, in the legal profession, if a judge has a connection or a conflict of interest in a case, he or she has to recuse him or herself and kind of step out and not try the case. Perhaps, you know, the case is something where if the company is found guilty of fraud, she's a major investor and she stands to lose a lot of her investment. But actually, it's a much bigger conflict of interest, examining the evidence for God. Think about it. If it's true, then we stand not simply to lose, you know, some of our money. We stand to lose everything. Our whole lives, in fact, in service of him. Now, I know this is actually quite hard teaching for us to hear at some level, that we, all of us by nature, are truth suppressors. We don't like that kind of teaching. Actually, it's crucial. Unless we start being aware of our natural bias, we'll never be able to approach this topic properly. And we'll never be able to approach it humbly enough to listen to God when he tells us to look for him where he says he'll be found. Now, actually, everything I've said so far is not enough. The passage that we've been looking at is written to argue that given the evidence out there, therefore we're without excuse when we don't worship God like we should. So this section is actually here to highlight our problem before God, but these verses don't give us the solution. And actually, if you ask Christian believers why they have faith in God, I think they may point to some of the arguments we've covered so far as something that first caught their interest or persuaded them that belief in God was at least rational. But invariably, if you probe them, the real reason why they're convinced God is real is because of Jesus. That's our third point on the sheets. Jesus reveals God. And I want to make clear that this isn't like the other two points. It's not that the third point is, you know, simply throwing another piece of evidence into the mix. The Christian claim is that in Jesus, we can truly know God. Not just know about God and agree on the basis of probability that he, you know, he's probably out there somewhere. That's Russell Brand's position at the moment. The Christian claim is much, much more than that. It's that through Jesus, we can actually know God personally. If you're not a believer, I wonder, this might be one of the most frustrating things for you about Christians. Someone at my old church said that before he became a Christian, he'd never lost an argument with a Christian. And he found it infuriating. You know, however hard he tried, however better his arguments were than theirs, he thought, they were never fazed by it. They never shifted their ground. But he came to see it wasn't because they were stupid or gullible. It's because they had personal knowledge of God. And therefore, of course, they weren't going to shift. But actually, this understanding, this discovery, if you're a sincere seeker after God, will come to you as a huge relief. Because what we're seeing here is that coming to know God is not reserved for the cleverest, the sharpest thinkers, although they're not excluded. Coming to know God personally is for anyone who will come to him humbly and actually look where God says he will be found, in Jesus. So let's look now at how it is that Jesus reveals God to us. And I'll put these sub-points here. Firstly, Jesus' claims. You probably know Jesus said some outrageous things. He said things like, "I am the way, the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." On another occasion, he said, "If you want to become my disciple, you have to love me so much that you have to hate your father and mother in comparison to your love for me." So Jesus' claims were so extreme, they don't even leave the possibility of him being merely a good teacher. Someone put it this way: if they're not true, his claims are those of a megalomaniac, compared with whom Hitler was the most sane and humble of men. So do you see, his claims mean that he's either much more than a great teacher, or he's much, much less. And one of the obvious things which backs up Jesus' claims, I've put there, is his miracles. If you read through the New Testament accounts, you'll see he healed the sick in their thousands. He interrupted funerals and raised up dead bodies. He created new material out of nothing, like bread and fish, and fed 5,000. He calmed storms with a word. And strikingly, no one at the time ever doubted that the reality of his miracles. There was all kinds of disagreement about where Jesus was getting his power from, but no one doubted it was real. And supremely, after Jesus died, hundreds of people saw him raised from the dead. So the New Testament accounts describe how on multiple occasions, sometimes even as many as 500 at a time, saw Jesus walking, eating, talking after he'd been publicly executed. And what's more, these people, the experience transformed their lives so radically that they went spreading this faith all over the world. Many of them, you know, died as martyrs rather than change their story. Now, I know there are people who don't engage at all with miracles. They say they will not countenance the possibility of miracles. But if that's you, can I suggest that refusing to consider data which doesn't fit into your system is a very unscientific, very silly way to approach the world? And actually, I would suggest it's further evidence of this natural bias that I've been trying to describe, that we're trying to look for ways not to believe in God. And I think what makes these Jesus events so intriguing is that the people Jesus convinced were first century Jews. So if you had to pick people from any time or place who were less likely to believe that the Creator God could take human form, it would be, anyway, they wouldn't believe it. The sentence is too long for me to remember how I began. No one would be harder to convince than first century Jews, because they believed in a transcendent God, a God who was so high, so much beyond us, that you couldn't even use his name in conversation. It was too holy. And yet it was these people who were convinced that for Jesus, no other language could fit for him. He is the eternal God. And what's more, these were the very people who would hang out with Jesus, who would eat with him and travel and live with him every day. Usually with great people, you know, they might look impressive from a distance, but when you ask the people close to them who know them well, they know about the ego or the hypocrisy or the selfishness or whatever it is. But it wasn't like that with Jesus. Those who knew him best were those who were most convinced that he was God. Now, when people hear about Jesus' claims and about his miracles, they sometimes say something like, well, fine, but all of this was so long ago. How can we know whether it actually happened? Couldn't it just have been an elaborate case of Chinese whispers? And I think this sounds, when you first hear it, like a very neat way of dismissing the claims. But actually, this objection doesn't really work. And it doesn't work, firstly, because the Bible is not written as legend. It's written as history. There's no question that the writers are presenting their accounts as accurate history. So that leaves us, either the New Testament documents are historical accounts, or they're written to try and deceive us. But there's a couple of reasons they can't be in that second category. They can't be fabrications. Firstly, because they're written too early. Today, all scholars, as far as I'm aware, would agree that the whole New Testament was written within a lifetime, and that some of the New Testament letters were written within only 20 years of the events they're describing. So it'd be like writing about Nelson Mandela being elected president today. The point is that the eyewitnesses were still alive, and they could easily have refuted these claims if they were made up. And then, of course, the movement would never have got off the ground. And the second reason why the New Testament documents can't be fabrications is because of this whole issue of who dies for a hoax. You see, nearly all the apostles died horrible deaths for what they were claiming, but not one of them went back on their story. So to say Jesus is just a legend isn't a plausible option. Well, what other options are there? Well, some people have claimed that Jesus must therefore be a liar or a lunatic. Perhaps he either deliberately deceived his followers, he was a liar, or he himself was deluded. He did it accidentally, and he was a lunatic. But these suggestions don't last very long when we consider, and that this is the next sub-point, Jesus' teaching. You don't have to be an expert to see that Jesus' world-shaping teaching is not the ravings of a madman or a con man. G.K. Chesterton put it like this. If I found a key on the road and discovered that it fit and opened a particular lock in my house, I'd assume that the key was most likely made by the lock maker. And if I found a set of teachings set in pre-modern times that has proven itself of such universal validity that has fascinated and satisfied millions of people in every century, including some of the best minds in history and the simplest hearts, if such teaching so obviously fits the locks of so many human souls in so many times and places, are they likely to have been the works of a deceiver or a fool? No, they're more likely to have been designed by the heart maker, Chesterton says. Now, there are super logical people who set out to try and disprove the evidence for Jesus, like the evidence for his resurrection. And very often, actually, they end up being persuaded by the evidence. And there are a couple of books I can recommend. I think they're on the bookstore by such people, if you want to follow up that approach. Other people get convinced by the Jesus' detailed fulfillment of lots of Old Testament prophecies. So there are lots of predictions about Jesus, which are fulfilled in his life. And that's, again, worth looking into. But I think more often, people are persuaded just by the incredible beauty of Jesus' character. No one's ever lived a life like Jesus. Jesus combines unique qualities. Despite his outrageous claims, we never see Jesus arrogant, pompous, or puffed up. He never stands on his own dignity. Even though he's approachable to the most weak and vulnerable people in society, he's completely fearless before the proud and the corrupt. Despite being profoundly human, and we often read of him being weary and lonely or very emotional, you know, given to joy or love or anger, we never see him moody. We never see him inconsistent. So he's never strong when he should be tender or tender when he should be strong. In fact, one writer summed up the miracle of Jesus' character with these words. No one has ever yet discovered the word Jesus ought to have said or the deed he ought to have done. Nothing he does falls short. In fact, he's always surprising you and taking your breath away because he's incomparably better than you could imagine for yourself. There's never a false step, never a jarring note. He is life at its highest. And perhaps most wonderfully, if you do read through the gospel accounts of Jesus' life, most wonderfully, you see this incredible determination that he has to lay down his life for lost people like you and me. And he went willingly through the most unimaginable torture and execution. And he did it for us. He did it to open up the way for us to know God personally. We began with a question, didn't we? How can we know whether God exists? Well, the wonderful news is that God isn't hiding. Creation and our own sense of God are enough to tell us God is real. We don't have to grope about in the dark, wondering about the truth. We can know for sure there's meaning in life, that right and wrong are real. They're not just preferences. We can know that we're here for a purpose, that human history is heading somewhere. But even better than any of these things, through Jesus, we can not just know about God, we can actually know the relationship that you and I were made for. In fact, we can have relationship with the one who loves us so much that he would come and die to restore us to himself. We're going to have a chance at the end after the service for questions and comments, objections, like we do every week. And I'd really encourage you to make the most of that if you've got things buzzing in your head right now. But as we close, I'd really encourage you, especially if you've never done it as an adult, to take away one of these eyewitness accounts of the life of Jesus. This one says John on it, and they're on the table at the back. and have a read for yourself, or perhaps better even, sign up to our Christianity Explored course that we run here on the barge, where you can get together in a group and think through some of these issues and bring any objections you have. In fact, if you're a convinced believer, why not do the same thing? I think there's 6 weeks now until Easter. We've just started Lent. So why not just pick one of these Gospels and read half a chapter a day between now and Easter as a way of counting down and reminding ourselves of who is at the basis of our faith, the Lord Jesus, and building our faith in him. And the reason why this is such a crucial thing for us to prioritise is because, as Professor Tolkien of Lord of the Rings fame put it, he said, "There is no tale ever told that men would rather find was true, and no tale which so many sceptical men have accepted as true on its own merits." We're going to have a time of quiet now before we sing. In a moment we're going to sing this next song that speaks of the wonder of the fact that the God who made this whole world is also the one who walked amongst us and who will one day put everything right in the world. But first, let's have a moment of quiet and reflect on what we've heard and how it applies to us.